This is WTJU Charlottesville, 91.1 FM and online at WTJU.net. The time now is 9 o'clock. It's time for Soundboard.
Welcome to Soundboard, Charlottesville's news straight from the source, only on WTJU. I'm Lewis Reining.
And I'm Susan Gravett. Today is Monday, June 9th, 2014. The weather forecast is partly cloudy, and the high will be 85 degrees, while the low will be 64.
Coming up on today's show, a former deputy county clerk for a court clerk for the county has been indicted, and Albemarle considers moving its court system. Plus, Charlottesville City Council has voted to increase water and sewer rates for residents.
Later on in the hour, we'll preview the new design for McIntyre Park before delving into the local food world by discussing cheesemongers and flash freezing.
These stories ahead on Soundboard, here on WTJU Charlottesville, 91.1 FM, the sound choice in Central Virginia. Dana Ockard, a former deputy clerk in the Albemarle County Circuit Court Clerk's Office, has been charged with embezzlement after being turned in by an unnamed fellow court employee. Ockard is accused of having stolen nearly $14,000 in court fees over a period of 4 years. We're joined by Graylin Bashir from Siva Weekly with more on this story. Graylin, before we get into the details, is this, we talked earlier about an investigation in the county clerk's office. Is that related to this?
Yes, this is the result of that investigation. So that was really, I guess, back in April that the local media got wind of it. And there was a special prosecutor brought in from Henrico, as you could imagine, if we're dealing with the Albemarle County court system. You can't have Albemarle County officials looking into it. And what we know now is that someone in the court, we don't know who, outside the clerk's office, basically brought this forward. There is a state law that says, you know, if you have any reason to believe that there's some kind of fraud going on, you know, within the court system, you've got to take that within the public body. You've got to take that to the state police and to local officials. And apparently Albemarle officials basically stepped back and said somebody else has to handle this. That began the investigation, and it culminated in the charge after a grand jury indictment of Dana Ockard, who had been with the clerk system there, the Albemarle County Court Clerk Office, for 24 years. She was a longtime court employee. She was the deputy clerk at the time that she stepped down shortly after this investigation was launched. So it seems that people who had worked with her at that point realized what was going on. But we, in talking with the prosecutor, learned quite a bit more about the nature of the fraud that was happening. And apparently what was going on was for at least 4 years, that's as far back as they have charged her with this, she was altering the records of cash transactions, allegedly. So, of course, none of this has been, you know, proven in court, but this is what she's accused of. When people came in to pay fees for civil procedures, say a name change or something along those lines, she worked in the civil division. Occasionally, she would make a false record of that so that if you're just flipping through the books, you wouldn't see a missing receipt, but it would be a fake receipt. It would be, for instance, the printers used to print out multiple carbon copies. She would save one of those if someone didn't want theirs and sometimes slip that in for another transaction, or she'd make photocopies of receipts and put them in, and then she would just pocket that cash and would not make an official record of that transaction. So it was very hard to trace, according to the prosecutor I spoke with, according to Debbie Shipp, who's the clerk, which is an elected position. And so when the numbers would tally up, there wouldn't be money missing, but she would have then pocketed the cash, apparently. So it's this issue is pretty important, besides the fact that this is $14,000 worth of money that belongs to the public that was steered out of the court system. It also comes on the tail of several years' worth of of long-running issues that have been pointed out by state auditors in that office, in Debbie Shipp's clerk's office. Issues of funds not being handled correctly, of really just this seeming tide of massive tide of paperwork that's kind of drowning that staff, and that they've just been unable to keep up with. And in some of those audits and reports, the state auditor said, you know, you're opening yourself up to fraud here. So when this happened, a lot of people thought back to those reports and have been talking to Debbie Shipp about that.
Now, since this had been, or she'd been employed there for over two decades, what kind of reaction did it get from her coworkers and people in the public who knew and respected her in this role?
Yeah, when I spoke with Ms. Shipp about it, she said it was really devastating for the office. She too has worked there for many, many years. They worked alongside each other for years, and she said it was really tough for everybody else in the office to deal with that. And Debbie said, you know, I was beating myself up over this and really upset about the fact that, you know, could I have caught this? And she said that in talking with state auditors, they said this sort of fraud was very hard to pick up on.
Where exactly will the case go from here in terms of the next steps in this whole process?
Well, she has turned herself in and was charged, and she has been released on her own recognizance, and there is a July 11th. Trial date for this.
That was Graylin Brashear from the Seville Weekly. Coming up next, could the county court system be moving? Stay with WTJU Charlottesville 91.1 FM for more.
That was James Harris Moore doing Aftermath. You're listening to Soundboard on WTJU 91.1 FM. I'm Lewis Reining with Susan Gravett.
Last Wednesday, the Board of Supervisors for Albemarle County directed its staff to continue studying plans to move the county's court system to a new site. At the same time, negotiations continue to keep the facilities in downtown Charlottesville. Charlottesville Tomorrow's Sean Tubbs is with us in the studio today to explain why the move is being discussed and what citizens can expect from these changes. Good morning, Sean. So, can you give us a bit of the backstory on the move for the courthouse?
Sure. Well, Albemarle County is growing. The population is projected to continue growing at a fairly high clip. And with that, the caseload for the court systems, because with more people comes more issues between people, let's say, both criminal and civil. So the idea here is that as that growth is projected to happen, as the need for more courts and a new courtroom potentially increases, the question is, do you renovate in place where the county's court system has been since 1763, or do you think about building it someplace else in the county? This might potentially spur economic development someplace, and it might be the better, according to some supervisors and according to some county staff, it might be the better direction to go as you're talking about spending $40 or $50 million.
At this point, what are the pros and cons to each of the sides of this argument, for moving and not for moving?
Well, that's kind of the question. So if you are a judge or if you're a lawyer, you would like to stay put, because right now, if you are if you have to be in the county system, you can just – and you have something to do in the city's court system the same day, you can just walk right across the street, or you're in the same area. If you're a county supervisor, and several of them complained about parking last week, you might want to consider putting something in the county, because you're potentially much less likely to come into county into parking problems, which was probably the number one reason cited by county supervisors last week when they brought this back up again.
So, Sean, you mentioned that the parking is one of the number one concerns for supervisors. Has the city given alternatives for how to expand parking or accommodate?
Well, that's what the city has basically said that they would like to do. They would like to say the Charlottesville Parking Center, which is the private company that runs the parking garages, a representative of theirs at a work session a couple of months ago said that we can work with you on parking. We have some solutions that we can potentially come up with, say a structured parking space on Market Street, a brand new place there. So there's all sorts of potential options, but of course in a place where cities, in a state where cities and counties are independent of each other, that there's nothing necessarily that compels the county to have to do this. So we're at a stage at this point where we're sort of opening up this issue again.
So, Sean, can I ask, is parking an immediate concern, or is it looking in the future parking is going to be problematic? What sort of timeline and timescale are we talking about in terms of the problem?
Sure. Well, it's a little bit of both. So, for instance, if you and, of course, you look like a reputable person, so I can't imagine that you would have any problem or need to be in the court system. But, Lewis, if you had been fined, and, of course, I am too, I have had very little interaction with the court system. But if you were in the city courts, you would be able to get a two-hour stamp. So you could park in the parking garage, you get that stamp, and you have it validated. If you are, if you had violated some rule in Albemarle County and were in their court system, you would not necessarily have that same stamp. So that might be a short-term fix to this issue. If the perception is parking, that's a particular idea there. The city has basically said that we'd like to work with you because, if you think about the effect of having all of those lawyers and all of those judges and all of those jurors in the city for those, that's meals eaten. It's all sorts of potential stuff. They don't want to see that happen. They'd like to see that potentially go. There's also the historical idea, the idea that in 1763 this land became the court, became the center of Albemarle's legal system. This is around the same time that the town of Charlottesville was created. The town of Charlottesville was created specifically for this purpose, was to be the urban area, was to be the civic space in Albemarle County. So you have that historical idea. And so the idea is that if the county decides to move the court system someplace else, there would have to be a referendum. Technically the county seat would have to would move to this new location, which hasn't been determined. It's also important to point out that at this point the county does not have any site identified for where they might put this. But, of course, there are lots of potential ideas. The county owns a lot of land across has a lot of undeveloped land in the county that could potentially be the center of the county's legal system as we cross into over, I think it was last year or the year before that the county jumped 100,000 people compared to 46,000, I believe, or 46,000 in the city. And so, as you prepare for this growth, and of course, as I write a lot about urban development and civic planning, this is an issue it's a pretty basic thing. People are going to continue to have disagreements with each other. Where is the best place to have that happen?
Perhaps this is a bit too premature to ask since there isn't really a location picked out yet for where this is all going to go, but what exactly is the funding looking like for this project? Are there projections as to just how much this could be? Or?
Well, this is the big thing, and of course, this is the issue, is that the estimated price tag for this is in the tens of millions, somewhere between $40 and $50 million. This would be, this comes from debt service. So in other words, the county will go, you know, just like any major capital infrastructure planning. A lot of it's potentially the sale of bonds if it becomes a really big thing. There's debt service, of course. So that's I think is a good question. Of course, it competes against things like roads, things like parks, things like sidewalks. But it's a major investment that has to happen because of course, that the court system, while not exactly falling apart, it does need additional capacity. And of course, you know, those buildings where they're currently located are old buildings. They're historic buildings, and they're historically protected buildings. And there's a lot of work that still needs to go into them to maintain them. And of course, one interesting thing is that if the county does move its court system someplace else, what happens to those buildings? And that's something, of course, that you know, there's always another story.
Indeed, there's always another story, and Sean Tubbs from Charlottesville Tomorrow will be with us to cover it. After our break, what's happening to the city water rates? Stay with WTJU 91.1 FM to find out.
That was Half a Mile from Here from Mark Schottinger. You're listening to Soundboard on WTJU 91.1 FM. WTJU is supported by UVA Health System, striving to advance medicine through research, dedicated to touching lives through patient-centered care. UVAHealth.com. I'm Susan Gravitt with Lewis Reining.
Last week, Charlottesville City Council voted 4-1 to increase residents' water and sewer rates by a double-digit percentage. We're joined by Shiva Weekly's Graylin Brashear to explore why the cost is going up and what concerns were voiced by the lone no vote. Graylin, if my understanding is one of the big drivers for this cost actually goes back to a discussion we were having for a long time several years ago in the water treatment system.
It does indeed. Some folks might remember the discussion about chloramines that sort of took over for quite a while, and that's part of why rates are going up. When we look at the wholesale cost of water, according to Tom Frederick, who's the head of the Rivanna Water and Sewer Authority, that is the sole reason that the wholesale cost of water that we're buying from the authority, that both Albemarle and Charlottesville buy from the authority, is going up. Because instead of using chloramines, there is this very special type of purification system that uses granular activated carbon. It's basically like the biggest, most fancy Brita filter you've ever seen. That's a real simplification, but it's great technology. It does an extraordinary job of filtering out impurities in water, which then reduces our need to chemically purify the water, which means we have fewer of these nasty byproducts from that process in our water. It's just that it's very expensive. It's a $19 million facility. It's going to have an operating cost annually of about $800,000. And so the authority has already built the debt for that, initial debt for that, into its budget. And so that is why, according to the authority, we're seeing these, the cost of water go up. It gets a little more complicated. Charlottesville has to pay a fair amount, has to charge people a fair amount in order to recover its own costs. It has aging infrastructure issues. You look at the amount, the difference between the volume of water that Charlottesville purchases from the RWSA versus how much is actually billed, and there's a pretty significant gap there, in part because of leaks, and also just because of unmetered usage, and it's can be hard to track that kind of thing, so you've got to cover that. But the reality is that that these rates are going up by about 12% for water and about 11% for sewer, which is, you know, you pay for it coming in, you pay for it going out. And that's that can be a real struggle for some folks here in Charlottesville. It disproportionately affects poor residents, as City Councilor Dee Dee Smith has pointed out. She was the one no vote on this decision to raise the rates. And her reasons for that go back to her disagreement with others on this negotiating committee that worked out how Charlottesville and Albemarle were going to share the costs of some various updates for infrastructure that they both rely on. That's a complicated issue in itself. But I talked with Dee Dee quite a bit about her points about how these water rates, why Charlottesville really needs to do more to try and bring those down for the city's poorest residents, you know, not so much necessarily the rate, but figuring out how to help them reduce usage.
And so, I think you've already started to hint at my follow-up question, which is, given so this increase is in response to the need to update infrastructure and to deal with this, add this granular activated carbon. What is Dee Dee Smith suggesting as an alternative to simply increasing the rates?
Yeah, you know, everybody that I've talked to so far has said the increasing cost of the resource is a reality, and we're going to have to deal with that. And one of the only ways is honestly by reducing use. This is sort of the new normal. But I want to get briefly into some of the issues that she has laid out about why it's such a problem. Charlottesville has a very high poverty rate for Virginia. We have almost a quarter of residents living in poverty, which is actually higher than Richmond, which a lot of people don't realize. And we see a very high rate of utility shutoffs because of non-payment, and that's something that Dee Dee's had an eye on for a long time. When it comes to water, there are a lot of opportunities for homeowners to get rebates for stuff that helps them reduce their water bill. For instance, a low flush toilet, which sounds kind of silly, but that, like, replacing all the toilets in Charlottesville would make a massive difference in water usage. The problem is we have a big rental culture here in Charlottesville. Most people rent. There are more renters than there are homeowners occupied homes. So when you're a renter, you are paying that utility bill, but you don't have the power often to make the updates that are needed, especially if you're poor. These things are expensive. Even with a rebate, it's hard to install that kind of thing. And it can be impossible to get your landlord's permission to do it, especially because that landlord doesn't have an incentive to fix it. You do, because you're paying the utility bill. So what we have are the folks who are most able to make the change doing it. Like, homeowners can make these adjustments. And that actually forces more of the cost, as Dee Dee puts it, onto the people who can least afford that. So it's a serious issue. And what she has suggested and hopes to see have happen is some of the city's staff resources directed toward analyzing water use in Charlottesville, looking at where there's massive overuse, it appears, on the map, because you can target down to building by building, and basically going to them and saying, how can we help you? So that's it's an issue that goes way beyond, you know, the numbers on the bill and the agenda item at City Council, but it's a really interesting one for a city that has an issue with poverty.
So where do we at the moment? Do we stand with the rates are going up and we're looking for a continuing discussion, but there isn't one yet happening? Or
yeah, the rates are going up. That's been voted on,
right?
And it's important to note that Albemarle's rates are going up too. and we don't mean to ignore that side of the issue, but I think a lot of people hope this is going to be an ongoing conversation about, you know, how do we deal with this expense that is unavoidable, that you have to have water in your house. You can't live without it. You have to be able to flush the toilet, but which disproportionately affects Charlottesville's poor residents.
That was Graylin Brashear from the Seaville Weekly. When we return, what will the new McIntyre Park look like? Stay tuned to WTJU 91.1 FM to find out.
Hi, this is the Rum Cove, and you're listening to 91.1 WTJU Charlottesville, the sound choice in Central Virginia. We invite you to tune in Mondays at noon for the Soulful Situation. The Rum Cove will bring you the Dixie Fried sounds from the Southern Soul centers of Muscle Shoals, Alabama, Memphis and Nashville, Tennessee, New Orleans and Shreveport, Louisiana, and also the Uptown Rhythm and Blues shots from the northern cities of Chicago, Detroit, New York and Philadelphia. Tune in to the Soulful Situation every Mondays at noon, and you can listen to the best of the soul hits and obscurities as the Rum Cove puts you in a situation that is so soulful.
Somewhere in the universe, a man sits hunched over a soundboard, his eyes staring intently at the bouncing green bars indicating the intensity of his voice. Somewhere else in the universe, you, the listener, sits in front of a machine that receives electrical signals and translates them into sound. From one person's mouth to another person's ears, it's No Soap Radio. No Soap Radio is brought to you by WTJU Charlottesville, 91.1 FM, or WTJU.net. It is designed for the aural stimulation of organic humanoids and will be found on the airwaves Saturday evenings at 11 o'clock post-meridian. Enjoy, humanoids. Enjoy.
Welcome back. That was Body Inside Out from Nettles. You're listening to Soundboard on WTJU. WTJU is supported by Charlottesville Inside Out, a public television show that introduces you to folks from in and around Charlottesville. people you know, and people you'd like to know. Host Terry Allard talks with local leaders in the arts, music, and education and discovers how entrepreneurs and nonprofits are shaping the community. Charlottesville Inside Out airs on WHTJ PBS Thursday evenings at 8:30. I'm Lewis Reining with Susan Gravett.
On Tuesday of last week, the Charlottesville Parks and Recreation staff unveiled the designs for an updated McIntyre Park during an open house at the Carver Rec Center. Planners are hopeful the new park will become a unique destination for area residents. Here to explain just what we can expect for the new and improved park is Reuben Jones, as well as Sean Tubbs from Charlottesville Tomorrow. Good morning, and Reuben, we have not had you on before, so welcome to Soundboard.
Good morning, thank you.
Before we get into what's coming up next for McIntyre Park, I wanted to kind of rewind and hear from you, because I know you know a little bit about the history of the park itself. So if you could just tell us, it's been around for 90 years, so there's a lot, but maybe give us a brief rundown.
Sure. So when Paul McIntyre donated the land for McIntyre Park, the park started as a park for white people in the city. But when he donated the land, he also donated Washington Park, which was the park for black people in the city. So when the golf course was started at McIntyre Park, black people were only allowed to play at the course one day a week. So it kind of has a troubled past, but, you know, it's gone through some changes, but it's pretty interesting to hear about the history of it.
And what exactly are some of the upcoming changes that we could expect? What are some of the proposals and ideas for the park now?
Sure. So 2 years ago, City Council approved a master plan for the eastern side of McIntyre Park. And just to be clear, the eastern side of the park is where the golf course currently is. The western side is where the baseball and softball fields are. So City Council approved this master plan, and the city, after they did that, hired two design firms to oversee the construction and design of the eastern side. So what the public got to see last week was the conceptual plan of what the eastern part could become.
And so what was the feedback people were giving, concerns, the things they were impressed with, or the changes they liked?
Yeah, so one of the main things, if you can believe it, in the past 90 years since the land was donated, the eastern and western sides of the park have never been connected. So one of the main features of the plan is that a pedestrian bridge would be added that goes over the railroad tracks and connects the two parts of the park. Some of the other features of the conceptual plan include a 8.5-acre botanical garden, an amphitheater, a family fun area that would include some sort of aquatic feature, as well as a new permanent home for the skate park. And something that was a little controversial when it was originally discussed was the golf course. And City Council decided that the golf course would be removed at the end of December 31st, 2016. It'll be replaced by a passive park area that will be made up of trails, grass, and trees.
Now, reading your article, one of the things that, if I remember correctly, there was a concern about the lack of rectangular fields for just all sorts of sports. And how did the planners come back and say, well, you know, we can put it in, or what was the response?
So, yeah, there was still concern from one person who was at the public input session. Of course, there are only about 30 people there, 40 if you include the city staff. But it was a major concern because the western side is made up of about 4 or 5 baseball and softball fields, but there are no rectangular fields. So there were some soccer advocates and other people, from other sports that really wanted a turf field. So this conceptual plan calls for one turf field, as well as some areas in the park that aren't specifically laid out as a turf field, but people can play sports on it.
And all projects like this obviously require some money to get off the ground. So what exactly are all of the features that would be part of this park feasible financially, or is there any question about how that might pan out?
So the good news for people who want those two sides of the park to be connected are that the pedestrian bridge is federally funded, and it's already been approved. So that could start as soon as late this winter or early spring, according to Parks and Rec. The other side of the coin is that the other features of the park are not federally funded, and they're more locally funded. So we'll have to wait and see when they will start. But according to Parks and Rec, some of the features like parking and maybe some of those trails could start in the next year.
Is there any proposal as of right now as to how much that might cost, or is that still too far into the future?
I asked them that, and they don't have those numbers yet, because part of the payment for the design firms was for them to take a look at how much it's going to cost for these added features. They will have those costs by the end of the summer.
And so we've had a public a public showing. I was about to say hearing, but not really hearing, a public showing. Are there other meetings lined up before the plans are finalized?
Yeah, the Parks and Rec is going to have a few more public sessions. They'll take a look at those, and then they'll eventually show it to City Council again. Now, I should mention that the skate park, which is currently has a temporary home on the eastern side of the park, will get a new permanent home. That's also going through a public input session as well.
Excellent. That was Reuben Jones from Charlottesville Tomorrow. After our break, you know about Virginia wine, but what about Virginia cheese? Stay with WTJU 91.1 FM for more.
Was Lightning by Hunter Smith and the Dead Men. You're listening to Soundboard on WTJU 91.1 FM. WTJU is supported by Charlottesville's Connection to the World, CHO Airport, with four major airlines serving six major hubs, including new service to New York, LaGuardia on American Airlines. Remember to always check CHO first. Learn more at GOCHO.com. I'm Susan Gravett with Lewis Reining.
Virginia is known for a variety of locally produced products, including a strong wine and beer industry, but one part of the local food movement is literally more cultured than the rest. Caramont Farm, run by Chef Gail Hobbs Page, has been making high-quality cheese for the past 8 years. To find out more about this lesser-known aspect of local food culture, we're joined by Charlottesville Tomorrow's Sean Tubbs, along with Gail Page herself. Thank you both for joining us. Sean, can you start out by just tell us how this even came on your radar?
Sure. Well, we have decided at Charlottesville Tomorrow to try to do a much better job, or to try to write a little bit about the local food movement that's going on here. Not only because the products are potentially delicious, but also because it's also part of preserving the countryside. And so I met Gail about 12 years ago when I first moved to Charlottesville, and it was finally time to write a story.
And how exactly did she get into the cheese game?
Gail, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. It's not a great connection, but I can hear you.
So,
good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Did you hear my question? I was just wondering how you got involved in the cheese game, can I call it that, into making and processing cheese?
Well, I basically approached this from a food perspective. I had been a chef and had cooked for many years, and you know, cheese to me was the best part of the end of the meal, and I thought rather naively that I could learn to make it, and I was also ready to transition out of a hot kitchen to a more pastoral life. My farm is south of Charlottesville, and we wanted to find a way to make it a farm, to keep it a farm. So that's really how the whole thing started.
And this might be a little too broad, but if it's at all possible, I was wondering just exactly what is the process for making cheese, because I'm sure you had to learn that and fine-tune it. So how did you go about that, and what is that like?
Well, we started out just making fresh cheeses and fresh Oops, getting a beep. Sorry about that. fresh cheeses really just mean that, in that you take the milk, you it's a very simple process where you add culture, you add rennet, and you wait 18 to 22 hours later, and it's cheese. You drain it, you salt it, and out you go. And we did that for the first, I think, four seasons. And then we decided that, you know, we were a little bored with that, and also we wanted to learn more about making more complex cheeses, and that's when I really I realized that I had approached this rather naively, and we decided to go back to school, so to speak, and we found the Vermont Institute for Artisanal Cheese, and I went up there and took some classes and started meeting other cheesemakers and learning basically the nuts and bolts of more complex cheesemaking and how we would bring that back to Virginia.
Gail, this is Lewis Reining here. I was wondering if you could expand just a little for us when you talk about learning that process. I'm curious, what are some of the aspects of the more complex cheesemaking that surprised you or that were a lot more difficult than you had first thought?
Well, there's a lot of chemistry to it. There's a lot of understanding components in the milk. There's a lot of understanding how the cultures work on those components, how flavors are developed, how aromas are developed. And that's just the culturing part. You know, there are different kinds of rennets for different kinds of cheeses. There's calf rennet. There's goat rennet. There's vegetarian rennet. And then there's also different kinds of aging. You know, some of our cheeses have wash rinds. Literally, we wash them with apple cider or wine. Some of our cheeses have bloomy rinds, very much like Brie or Camembert. So you see, it's not you start out with milk, but, you know, further down the road, it's a much more complex scenario.
And I was reading in the article that Sean put together about some of the different people that kind of helped you get into the cheese game and learn a bit more about how to make it. Can you tell us about some of the partnerships you formed with people in the area to get this process underway?
Well, in regard to distribution or in regard to cheese making?
Maybe a little bit of both. I was thinking more of the cheese making, but...
Well, I'm proud to say that we've had our share of interns and employees that have come through here. Bridge Cox was here for 3 years. He and his partner, Kyle Kilduff, have started a dairy at Bel Air Farm called 20 Paces. Bridge brought a lot to our program. He was a really smart cheesemaker. He also did the classes up in Vermont. And I feel like during his tenure here, he really kicked our cheese making up a notch. And just in regard to the longevity of our project, I think that, you know, one of the things that we've really had to tackle is our distribution. This project has always drawn really good people that wanted to help and support us as a local business. You know, my friends at the local food hub, Lisa Reeder and Alan, have been great in helping me solve this mystery, as well as Cavalier Produce. And, you know, I always say if it was just the farming and being with the baby goats and all that stuff, it would be the greatest thing in the world. Unfortunately, you know, making a living at local food is more than that. It's really pulling a lot of different elements together so that you can have a perishable, profitable product. It's been our biggest challenge in the latter part of this project.
Well, Gail, you touched on exactly what I wanted to ask about, which is, you know, you've been doing this for 8 years. I'm curious, in getting it going and building that momentum, what are those real
What are the difficulties in creating that sustainable business? What are the things that are most difficult, I guess, is what I'm curious about.
Well, you know, you have to have a certain amount of product to sustain labor. And, you know, it's not like we can go out and, you know, we're not making T-shirts. We can't just go buy more T-shirts and silkscreen them. You know, we have to get goats. We have to get cows. It takes a lot of planning. It's something that is at sometimes totally out of our control in regard to Mother Nature, you know, and sometimes your accounts don't really understand that something died or, you know, it snowed or, you know, there was a derecho or something like that. But, you know, that's part of it. We're making a product out of a living thing. It takes a lot of daily work to keep that living thing healthy and happy. You know, we also have an extremely complex regulatory system developing, cloud looming, and I don't think people really understand the complexities of the regulatory climate right now in cheese making and food production in general. So those are two of my current challenges is, you know, producing enough cheese to sustain my labor, I guess I would say, and to help me buy more equipment. Cheese making equipment is very, very expensive and virtually unknown in this part of the world. Most of it comes from Europe. And also our complex regulatory climate, which is really in the news these days.
Actually, that was something that I was going to ask you. I was reading on the way in here that that the FDA has issued this this new ruling that you can't age cheeses on wood.
I'm glad you asked me that.
Does that affect you?
It does affect me. It is catastrophic news for the artisan cheese movement in the United States. And I'm a member of the American Cheese Society, and we got the action alert on Friday that this had happened, and I'm just hoping that there can be some sort of groundswell to challenge it. This will greatly change the way cheeses are made and aged in the United States.
And, of course, I think we only have a couple of not too much time here, but I'm certainly going to follow up on that myself. But just for the average listener, can you just describe, if you can't use wood to age your cheese, how does that affect the character and the quality and the flavor of the cheese?
Well, you know, when you age cheese and you know, very quickly thumbnail sketch, I mean, that part of it is called affinage, and that's how you develop the rind on the cheese. The wood acts as a natural antimicrobial. It gives it flavor, it gives it nuance, and it keeps it safe. It's been done for over 1,000 years in France, and it is absolutely mind-boggling why we would all have to switch to plastic.
Gail, so that story is definitely going to be unfolding, and we'll do our best to keep up with it and to, as we learn more. I'm curious, though, for the moment, your own future growth. I mean, particularly as we just talked about, in the face of this new setback.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
The question was on future growth.
Oh, well, you know, I did an event at Veritas Vineyard on Friday night, and a fellow asked me, you know, what was next for us, and I immediately said, I want a cheese cave. I would like to see a community cave where we, as cheesemakers in Central Virginia, we'd have a place to put our cheeses and age them and really, you know, enhance the complexity of what we do. You know, and that's why one reason I was so devastated by this decision, because it certainly does change things. But we're just going to keep on doing what we do. We're going to not try to be a great big cheese company. We don't want to do that. We want to stay within our economy of scale and continue to make great cheeses and make them better.
And it sounds like you all have a really great business going, especially for the area. But, you know, you've kind of sold me. And if I wanted to go buy some of your cheeses, what are some of the stores that I might have to go to pick it up?
Well, you know, our core stores have always been Kate and Eric at Feast. They carry everything that we make and always have. They're great. Flora Artisanal Cheese, which is a new shop in the Millie Joe's coffee shop. Najib is a young fellow with a tremendous amount of passion for cheese. So I would say those two. We do sell to grocery stores, but normally it's not our full line. You know, they have a hard time with different sizes and different, you know, they just need things to be more uniform. So those are the two that I really enjoy sending people to.
It was a pleasure having you on this morning. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for talking about this. It's great stuff.
Hopefully we'll have you back. I always love to talk about cheese and wine. So.
All right. Take care.
That was Sean Tubbs from Charlottesville Tomorrow, along with Caramon's Gail Hobbs Page. Next on Soundboard, could national chains eventually carry frozen foods produced in Albemarle? Stay tuned to WTJU 91.1 FM for more.
That was All's Well That Ends Well, That Ends, by The Hill and Wood. You're listening to Soundboard on WTJU 91.1 FM. I'm Lewis Reining with Susan Gravett.
Recently, Charlottesville and Albemarle received a joint agriculture and forestry industries development grant from the state to plan a flash freezing facility. Such a facility stands to radically change the local food movement and may help extend the reach of local products. Joining us with more on this very cool story is Graylin Brashear from the Seaville Weekly. Now, flash freezing facility, kind of the name tells us what it might be and what it might do, but could you go a bit into the specifics of that title?
Sure. So it's pretty pretty straightforward process. When you eat frozen vegetables, you're eating veggies that have been and fruits that have been flash frozen. It's a way to preserve stuff when it's fresh, and it's a great way to have really nutrient rich foods available on a much wider scale, because obviously produce rots. So having a flash freezing facility where local food could come would mean that you would sort of fix some of the logistical issues with getting local produce that is seasonal, that comes in large bulk quantities, you know, from farms at a specific time of year, that could spread it out and would really be a shift in the economics of growing local food. And people see this potential and have been talking about it in this area for a while. The Jefferson Area Board of Aging, JABA, actually started the ball rolling on this with a feasibility study, and they were looking at it from the standpoint of how could we expand our efforts to get meals to people, to the elderly in the area. They were looking at pre-cooked meals that then could be flash frozen themselves, not just produce. But the local food hub also is interested in the idea. The same kind of facility could be used to freeze local produce, and that could go pretty far in advancing what the local food hub tries to do, which is connect small local farms with these bigger local markets. For instance, institutions like schools, like the university, like hospitals in the area that could really benefit from healthy, great, locally grown food, and so could the farmers from this relationship. But it's hard for all the reasons we just mentioned, this issue of, you know, you have local food coming in at one time of year and in large quantities. It's hard to establish a buy-sell relationship with a larger market when that's the case.
Graylin, really quick, just to establish sort of the backstory here, how is that food handled right now in dealing with that large quantity all at once?
That's a story unto itself, related to the founding of the local food hub in 2009. They do have a warehouse here. They've been a really they've done great work in sort of connecting those markets. They're really coming in and saying, you know, how can we be a proper go-between? The idea of a freezing facility would expand that, simply because it would mean that that this stuff could last longer. You could have a trickle instead of a whole flow at once of this food. So it's important to note this is in the study phase. So that's where the grant comes in, which is what the story that was in the CVL a couple weeks ago is about. The Agriculture and Forestry Industries Development Grants, AFID, come from the state, and McAuliffe sort of has spearheaded this shortly after he was sworn in, the governor. And the idea is, here's some money. Study how you can expand agriculture in your community. You double the amount, or you get a larger amount, if you partner with a neighboring municipality. So Charlottesville and Albemarle saw some opportunity here, and they went in together. And Chris Engel, Director of Development for Economic Development for Charlottesville, spearheaded this, and they got it. They got a $35,000 matching grant. Charlottesville and Albemarle have to put up the other $35,000. And it is to develop a business plan here. So we're far off from any actual facility, but this is a really important first step. You have to dig in. You have to look at demand. You have to look at where the infrastructure could go, and that's what they're doing now.
And how long do we know how long this study is supposed to take?
It's not clear. I'm not totally certain that the grant probably has a lifespan that they're looking at. But this is something that is that would be years in the making. But really a potentially really exciting one. There's nothing like this in Virginia, in the Central Virginia area. Nobody has tried to do this specifically, as an effort to up the capacity of the local food producers to supply the market that might want to consume their food. So it could be a really cool shift.
And Graylin, I know this is a big topic, and we only had time to just touch the surface. For anyone who wants to read more, where can they go?
Well, cville.com/news is always where you should go. But you can find this story that we're talking about still on there. Just scroll down a little ways in the news page, and we'll be following up to see how that study is going.
That was CVL Weekly's Graylin Brashear. And that's a wrap for today's edition of Soundboard. Many thanks to our guests, Gail Hobbs-Page, Graylin Brashear, Sean Tubbs, Ruben Jones, and to our producer, Robert Packard. I'm Lewis Reining.
And I'm Susan Gravett. Soundboard is a production of WTJU, CVL Weekly, and Charlottesville Tomorrow. To listen to an archive of today's show, visit WTJU.net. We're also podcasting the show at seavilletomorrow.org and sea-ville.com.
Our theme song is Kyoja Beep by Mawen Alasco and Jay Pun. All of today's musical selections came from local artists in the Central Virginia region. Soundboard will return tomorrow at 9 a.m., but stay tuned now for The Jazz Messenger with Brian Kina, only on the Sound Choice in Central Virginia.